give up, don't give up, never give in.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
And welcome to another edition of Labor Radio here on CKUT. It's the January edition. We're January 20th, 2022. Happy New Year to everybody. I'm Stefan, always joined by
your co-host and Mustafa Henaway, and very excited for this edition of Labor Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
So we have one interview today, which Mustafa can tell you about in a moment. Just wanted to mention a few things, a little house cleaning off the top. You can find us on Facebook. You can also find our episodes archived on the CKUT website, as well as our own Labor Radio Mixcloud. We're also members of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, which you can find as well on Facebook or just through any search engine, where you'll find lots of labor-oriented podcasts, mostly from North America, but also from Brazil and elsewhere. And so we're happy to be part of that network. So what do we have on the show today, Mustafa?
Well, on today's show, we have a very special set of interviews. So two interviews with Dohan Mahdi, as well as Rabab and Naeem, and both are Sudanese activists involved currently in the struggle for democracy and social justice, and have been active since the beginning of the Sudanese revolution. which is now at a critical phase. We're talking about a general strike that was launched on the 18th of January after a heightened level of violence by the security forces as protesters continue to demand an end of the military regime. And so we're really lucky to have these two guests. And Rabab Al-Naim is one of the actual the spokespeople for the restoration of the trade unions in Sudan, and as well as the Sudanese Workers Alliance. Or no, Rabab Al-Naim is the spokesperson for the Sudanese Workers Alliance for the restoration of trade unions in Sudan. And also Duha Al-Mardi is an organizer, a member of the Sudanese community in Montreal, and comes from an environmental education background and has been active since really the beginning of the revolution. So it's going to be a real great discussion, I think, with these two activists who've been following and have been active in the revolutionary process for the last 2 years. So I think this is going to be a great episode. So, and it's rare that we get to talk with activists from the Global South, and particularly not just strikes over economic issues, but, you know, the strike as a political tool to bring down a military regime. So I'm very excited for this.
Absolutely. Really looking forward to hearing from those two. But before we go to the interview, just wanted to also speak to a few other issues of interest to people involved in labor. First, on the provincial level, the Minister Jean Boulet just announced a raise in the minimum wage. So this was kind of to be expected. It happens every few years and whatnot. It's also a critical time for minimum wage earners because inflation is basically getting almost out of control. So the minimum wage in Quebec is going to pass from $13.50 to $14.25 on the 1st of May. That's about a 5.6% increase. But other things to note as well is the for workers who get tips, their minimum wage goes from $10.80 to $11.40 an hour. And it's important to note that tip workers have not been getting very many tips for the last 2 years, if you know what I mean. Like, restaurants are at 50%, if not just closed. The sort of tip-based industries obviously have been compromised basically by the COVID pandemic. So their increase is a little bit bigger it's not even bigger, sorry. It's a 60-cent increase instead of a 75-cent increase. So it's actually smaller. And basically, all this to say, there's about 300,000 minimum wage workers in Quebec. This is not going to do very much for them. And the unions just went from the previous coalition of the Fight for 15 to a demand for $18 an hour. And this is obviously very far off from that.
No, and obviously the inflation that, you know, when the measure of inflation doesn't include housing, right? And doesn't include the amount that housing has gone up drastically, especially, I mean, across most cities, but more acutely in Montreal. So it doesn't even include those statistics around one of the most major single costs that any working person actually has, which is housing. So it's clearly the minimum wage raise is not enough to actually to pay the rent and put food on the table. And we're talking about during the pandemic, a historic number of billionaires being created throughout the pandemic. So yeah, it's clear that people should be supporting the demand for 18, but obviously we should be going for higher or you know, for actual maximum wages, not higher minimum wages.
Mm-hmm.
But
not there yet.
No.
No. And also just another dynamic to keep in mind is that 55% of minimum wage earners are women. So it's also a wage equity issue. So something to keep in mind as some people might be thinking that this is a good thing. I mean, it's not a bad thing per se, but it falls quite short of what's necessary. Another interesting development came to my attention yesterday, and this is an initiative. The reason why it's important to me is it's an initiative that groups the FTQ and the Fonds d'Action, which is the CSN's investment trust, with the Coalition of Chambers of Commerce of Quebec, as well as the Conseil Patronal du Québec, the bosses association, in a sort of proposal for solidarity, prosperous and green economic recovery for Quebec, which is a very weird, watered down, kind of tepid proposal that sort of doesn't really sound much different than the ones that are proposed by the CAQ to begin with. So it's just a little bit bizarre and disappointing to see the unions kind of throw away their credibility in these kind of coalitions with the ruling class in Quebec for projects that really don't really have like a interesting horizon for workers to begin with. So we're not really getting any gains from these kinds of coalitions, and frankly they just look embarrassing for the labor movement, in my opinion. You can check it all on their website. It's G15 Plus is the name of the project. So this was just a sort of bizarre thing to come across on my desk this week.
No, it's beginning to see the co-optation of you know, climate change and the fight against climate change as being one merged with profits.
Yeah, under the cover of some kind of cross-class collaboration. It's a very weird system. But I mean, it's not an unprecedented one by any means. Anyways, just something to keep an eye on, and definitely a trend to reverse. One last thing that I wanted to bring up before we go to the interview. The Center for Indian Trade Unions announced a February general strike for 2 days under the slogan Save the People, Save the Nation. So it's February 23rd and 24th. Last time that the CITU organized the general strike, we remember we interviewed Comrade Tappan Sen, the general secretary. And he, you know, it was the biggest strike, I think, in the history of the world. This might not be the same, but it sort of comes on the heels of the victory against the Modi government of the repeal of the farmers' bills, which was in large part the subject of the last general strike that they had about a year ago, just over a year ago now. So something to watch out for next month.
No, it seems like 2022 might be starting off in a way that's, you know, where we're actually seeing a renewed amount of struggle and revolts across the board, right? From Sudan to India. So on all those issues, obviously, we'll talk more in the coming months, you know, from the minimum wage campaign to the $18 minimum wage campaign to the Indian general strike. And also unions around the question of climate change. But we're going to go right into our interview on today's focus, Sudan, the revolution, and the role of labor and trade union renewal in Sudan in the face of the military regime. So you're listening to Labor Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We'll be right back.
And welcome to Labor Radio here on CKP 90.3 FM. And we are joined by our two very special guests for this episode, Rabeb and Naeem, as well as Duhal Mardi, and joined from two very different places, but have been involved in the Sudanese revolution and really one of the most impressive struggles across both in the global south, but in Africa and the Arab world, really to this date, continuing mass demonstrations, neighborhood resistance committees, and have continued the revolutionary process despite attempts by the military regime at co-optation, which we'll speak about, you know, at length during the interview. But the urgency for this kind of interview is that January the 18th and 19th, a general strike was called in Sudan against the military regime, but in particular against the heightened violence by the security forces of the military, and the deaths of large amounts of activists. So from trade unions to the neighborhood resistance committees, have all called for a general strike on January 18th and 19th. And so to talk about this and also context of the revolution, we're joined by Rabeb and Naeem, spokesperson for the Sudanese Workers Alliance for the Restoration of Trade Unions. She's also a co-founder of Tahmar Bouta, a feminist podcast that discusses topics from our daily lives and the intersections with capitalism, colonialism, and other systems of oppression in an attempt to question and rethink social structures and dismantle, build new institutions as humanity struggle towards liberation. Also with us, Duhal Mardi, who is a great activist here in the city of Montreal, is an organizer and member of the Sudanese community here in Montreal. She comes from an environmental educational background and is a graduate of Concordia's Community Economic Development Program and works with climate justice student groups and support for refugee claimants here in Montreal. So, thank you so much, Duha and Rabeb, for being on Labor Radio here today on CKUT.
Thank you, Mustafa, for having us.
Thank you, Mustafa. Thank you.
So for our listeners, before we get into the role of labor, and I'll leave it to either one of you, is to give some context. How did we get to this moment in Sudan in terms of this general strike, in terms of giving context both to the revolution itself and also to the situation where you now have had the resignation, where Hamdan also came back but then had also resigned? And so if some context to people who don't know much about the Sudanese revolution and why it's taking place now and the length of the process that's been going on.
Yeah, so I can give the context, and Rabeb also, of course, feel free to jump in like whenever if I'm missing any point or you want to add to it. But yeah, so I think the more recent context, because I think if we talk about Sudan, we can go back to so many different years for context, right? We can go back to 1989 for other context, for more deeper context, or even before that. But I'm going to start with December 2018. There was a wave of demonstrations that started from Ad-Damazin and Adbara and moved on to a nationwide scale. Partly it was due to rising cost of things like bread and fuel and basically the deterioration of the economic conditions of people. And then the protests have shifted demands to a call for the fall of the dictator Omar al-Bashir and his regime. The slogans at the time were "Tazgud Bas," which means "just fall, that's all." And people were calling for "Hurriya, Salam, Adala," freedom, peace, and justice. The protests, of course, at the time were met with excessive use of force, killing dozens of people, injuring hundreds of people. In February, Omar al-Bashir declared a state of emergency, but of course, that didn't stop anything. And then actually the more major updates was on the weekend of April 6th and 7th, where a large sit-in in front of the headquarters of the Sudan Armed Forces in Khartoum was called on to. Of course, there were millions of people who were gathered there leading up to Omar al-Bashir being removed from power on April 11th. He was briefly replaced by the military general Awad ibn Auf, who resigned in one day because of the pressure from the protesters in the street. And then General al-Burhan, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, took over the Transitional Military Council. And the sit-in and protest, of course, continued, demanding the military council to step down and to hand in the power to a civilian government. There were negotiations that started between civilian opposition sort of leaders and the Transitional Military Council all throughout late April and May, hoping to reach to some kind of agreement. This was partly also mediated by the African Union and Ethiopia. And then on June 3rd, the Transitional Military Council did a crackdown of the sit-in and basically committed a massacre in Khartoum. They killed 128 protesters. They torched down tents. They raped about 70 people. They threw down bodies in the Nile, injured and arrested many people. And actually, some people are still missing from that day. They have not been found. This was then followed by 3 days of general strike, which I think ended in the third day with some political prisoners being freed. And then eventually negotiations actually resumed again in July. A power sharing deal was made between the Transitional Military Council and what's known as the FFC, the Forces of Freedom and Change. And there was a draft constitutional declaration that was signed between them on August 17. So while these negotiations, by the way, were happening, violence was still happening across the country. In July, there was the rapid support forces. They attacked school students in Al-Lubayd who were protesting, you know, lack of public transportation because of the unavailability of fuel, lack of availability of bread. They actually killed 5 students and they injured dozens of them. So this was happening while there was a power sharing conversation going on. So in terms of the power sharing deal itself that happened, the composition and the structure of this was basically to have a sovereignty council to head the state with a mix between civilian and military leadership. And Abdullah Hamdok was also declared as prime minister of Sudan. And this was supposed to be a total period of 39 months. Well, there have the first 21st months of this is to be headed by a military leader. And then the remaining 18 months power to be transferred to a civilian leader, eventually leading up to an electoral process. So this was what the deal was. Of course, there was a lot of questions about this deal, right? The power dynamics are extremely unequal, obviously. There was obviously, you know, one side here, which is the military, that actually had more power than the other one. So there was a lot of questions in terms of how this was going to go anyways. But it still went on until leading up to this coup. And of course, also like since that time, I want to say like really a lot of the demands that people had throughout this transitional period were not met. One of them, for example, was demanding justice and accountability for the June 3rd massacre, which I talked about earlier, and nothing came out of that. There were investigation committees that were put, but nothing came out of it. Economic conditions of people continued to deteriorate throughout this period. And leading up to the October coup, actually a little before that, there was a split going on within the Forces of Freedom and Change, with some groups like the Justice Equality Movement, for example, that's headed by Dr. Jibril Ibrahim, so the Sudan Liberation Movement that's headed by Minyar Kuminawi, and others have formed, basically they've split up from the main FFC and formed their own thing called the National Accord Group. Citing this as a result of basically lack of representation and some unfairness going on in the FFC. And of course, the military echoed all of this and used all of this and called for a dissolution of the transitional government. This was followed by massive nationwide protests actually on October 21st. So just a couple of days before the the coup took place, there were massive nationwide protests in Sudan supporting democratic civilian rule, in spite of a lot of people at the time really being fed up of the situation in Sudan, both from the military and the FFC as well. There were feelings of disappointment from the Sudanese people that all of these bodies have failed to meet the demands. But in spite of that, people went out on October 21st to support a democratic civilian rule. And then, of course, on October 25th, the military conducted a coup, this headed by Al-Burhan and Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Himeti from the Rapid Support Forces and others. And they arrested the prime minister, they arrested some civilian leaders, they shut down the internet and calling and messaging services across the country. They arrested and attacked members of resistance committees and protesters and so on. And of course, since the coup, there has been continuous marches and calls to action. It's actually intensified a lot despite the heavy and excessive use of power. And I'll let Rabab actually talk more about the resistance side and how that's going. I want to say, like, actually all throughout this deal, all throughout 2020 and 2021, the state has been using excessive force to suppress protests throughout the country. There is violence across Sudan. Many incidents, can tell us this, the incidents in Zalinje, in Fateh Birnu, more recently the violence in Jabal Moon in West Darfur state, which resulted in 24 people being killed. So this was happening throughout this deal, and in spite of Juba peace agreements and in spite of all of the things that the state was using about talking about, peace, and that we want to promote peace in Sudan and that's why we are here. There was no peace throughout this time. And the forces that are committing these crimes really are a variety of forces. We have the police, the Rapid Support Forces, Central Reserve, military intelligence officers, and more recently, Al-Burhan actually allowed back a lot of the operations of the intelligence to go back again. And these are obviously, intelligence of Islamist forces and Al-Bashir intelligence. So really kind of the same state, if not even more intensified. And the attack of protesters in protests, people who are peacefully demanding their rights are attacked with gunfire. There's been with evidence use of anti-aircraft weapons in residential places and in attacking protesters. They also use tear gas canisters, both to injure people and of course to cause suffocation and there's actually even been conversations about the type of tear gas that's being used, that it's a little bit different this time and causing different reactions in people's bodies. Even as close as this Monday, actually this week, the 17th, seven protesters in Khartoum were killed, and the Central Committee of Sudan Doctors reported 167 people injured on the 17th, 52 of which are actually a result of live ammunition shooting. And this brings the total of people who are killed by the military coup since October 25th only to above 70. So really there's been an undeniable excessive use of power. The state has continued to use sexual assaults on women's bodies as a form of political weapon across Sudan. There's been an attack on medical facilities. They've been arresting and attacking journalists, activists, resistance committee members, and even actually they use strategies of criminalizing and demonizing the protesters who are more on the front line and more on the radical end. They have been demonized and criminalized a little bit by the state, as we have seen recently with the group Ghadiboun, for example. And this has been a strategy that's been used by the al-Bashir regime multiple times. This regime as well, it's really the same kind of divide and conquer strategy. The last thing really I want to add on this is that there has been international bodies that have been stepping in to call for dialogues, like UNITAMS, for example, and African Union and other bodies. And they have been calling for a dialogue basically. And this is not acceptable for the Sudanese people. This is, nobody wants this right now. If you are listening to what the street is saying, the street is clearly saying that we do not want any negotiations, we do not want any partnership, and we do not want to go back to a state of pre-coup, like before the 25th, because that has proven its complete failure at this point. So these calls for dialogue and for the two sides, there are no two sides here. There's no two sides. There is a side that is a murderer, and there are people demanding their rights peacefully. So these kind of calls for people to come and sit down on the table are really counter-revolutionary and really against what people in Sudan want. I'll leave it to Rabab to jump in.
Perfect. Thank you, Doha. And thank you, Labor Radio. I just want to start by first stating glory to the martyrs of Sudan. And also, I want to, although I'm a spokesperson for Suharto, I am not here to speak on behalf of Suharto. I'm here on a personal level. And I want to start with the point that Doha very clearly made, that the strategy that this regime, the current regime, the current state in Sudan is using has been the same strategy that was used since 1989, since the coup that brought Islamic power and Omar al-Bashir. And actually, I can go as far as in the 70s, because the same economical policies have never changed. And the push for the way I see it is actually the wave of protest started maybe December 6th. I know the Maazin was a larger in December 13, 2018 was a larger scale protest, but started in December 6 in Mayerno in Sinnar, where school children actually took to the street demanding for bread. They shut up the school and basically no bread. So they took the street. And so right now, like Doha mentioned before, the resistance in Sudan is basically made of two arms: neighborhood resistance committee and organized labor movement. Neighborhood Resistance Committee have been in Sudan maybe since 2013. Also in September 2013, we had, I hope you guys can still hear me because I just got a phone call from my—
Yeah, we can.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So in September 2013, we had a wave of protest in Sudan. And that was the start of formation of the Neighborhood Resistance Committee. With time, it continued to develop. And I, unlike Mustafa mentioned earlier, the calls for a strike and hopefully for this strike to evolve toward a civil disobedience in January, in this January 18 and 19, this was not the first time. Sudan have been, I can say, in a civil disobedience status maybe since December 6, 2018, if not since 1989 when Omar Bashir came into power. And to argue for that, the Sudan have been in civil disobedience, we have to go back and think of what do we mean by civil disobedience. We're basically at a state where our moral code, us collectivists, the people of Sudan, and our political interest, our economical interest, our social interest is beyond the state. So we're no longer interested in following the law that is actually was put into power by the state to maintain the same power structure. So the fact that Neighborhood Resistance Committee have appeared in 2013, this tells you that people have been organizing since 2013. And on the side of organized labor movement, unions have always been used as a weapon by the state. But during Omar al-Bashir era, there was a lot of parallel union movement. There was a lot of strike among different sectors, for example, teachers, doctors, and different other sectors. So there's always two type of union or like labor movement. One that is used as a weapon by the state, and one is against the state. We're definitely interested and we're definitely biased with the labor union movement that is against the state. Especially with the type of the three no's that we have, like Toha mentioned earlier, no negotiation, no compromise. If we're trying to reach our goal of freedom, peace, and justice, then that definitely has to go through labor movement. But it's more challenging to organize in labor for so many different reasons. Economically speaking, privatization has been in Sudan since the 70s. Economical policies have never changed, and this definitely affect labor relations and affect the ability to organize. And we basically have the gift of neighborhood resistance committee to help us until our labor movement is strong enough to support. So the fact that the heightens in violence, especially in this January, labor movement stepped in to say that we are here and we are part of this struggle and we are equal and we are as important as resistance neighborhood committee. And actually there is no separation, because at the end of the day, the right to life indicates or has to go through a right to decent work, decent labor. So definitely that cannot happen without organized labor. That comes with its own set of challenges. Basically, the question of a lot of theoretical and a lot of practical questions, because most of the work force in Sudan right now, at least in the formal sector, have never really practiced or lived within a democratic environment. And I usually get very hesitant on just throwing the word democracy, because democracy is very... democracy for the benefit of who, right? Is it democracy or some sort of stabilization that will allow the same power structure to continue? Or is it a democracy that for the benefit of poor people, for the benefit of the working people of Sudan? So some of those theoretical and practical question is the question of the relationship between organized labor and improving labor conditions, and between politics. Usually labor movements are against an employer or maybe against a certain sector. But what's happening in Sudan right now is labor union is actually against the state itself. And then the revolution will continue as we will continue, even after achieving our goals, we will continue to improve labor movement and labor condition, labor relationship. And this also has to do with the fact that a lot of just giving the economical situation and privatization of health industry, education industry, all type of sectors in Sudan, most of the working class in Sudan actually work in the informal sector. So they're not even recognized by the state. Yet, they are always a victim of the violence of the state. So our struggle here to begin with is with the state, but even to do that, we have to go through struggle with the employer. For example, within the last 2 weeks, even before the call for the strike on the 18th and the 19th of January 2020, we have seen calls for a strike in Bank of Khartoum, which is the biggest bank and the oldest bank in Sudan. And it started as asking for better wages. We've also seen teachers asking for better wages and better teaching environment. We've also seen oil workers. We've also seen so many different sectors. Basically, since December 6, 2018, until this very moment that we're speaking right now, Sudan have been in civil disobedience in one way or another. And I want just to focus on the fact that there is different ways of nonviolence resistance, right? One of them is the Neighborhood Resistance Committee, and one of them is coming up with different strike. We need to answer so many theoretical questions. We need to answer so many practical questions in terms of labor. Like I said, for example, the informal sector. How do you include the informal sector in strikes, right? They are part of the revolution. They're basically part of the Neighborhood Resistance Committee. They exist daily in mass protests. But how do you put them as a working class, as a power, as a work collectively, and how to use to collect that power to advance your goals? So these are part of the questions. And all of this really comes to the main question of how do we restore unions or labor movement? And why do we even ask that question? Is because basically there has always been a tendency for a separation between unions and organized labor and between actually working, the working class itself. And this is very common within dictatorships, and actually also common within liberal democracy, where you actually build some sort of a superficial body that does not represent the working class, that does not represent their interests, but you basically try to put them in a loop of demand after demand after demand. And like I said, I truly believe, like whenever I hear this, the statement of the revolution continues, or it's not just for freedom, peace, and justice. It actually mainly has to do with the right to life through the right to decent labor. We want to go even beyond unions. We want to go into co-ops. We want the working class to actually have the power, like whatever profit margin that you provide, whatever you create, you need to have the right to distribute that, right? It's about distributing, redistribution of wealth. It's about balancing the power structure. I don't want to go on. I think I'll prefer if you guys ask questions and me and Duha, we can exchange ideas. So Mustafa or even Stefan, feel free to ask questions and we can move ahead, because it's a lot. Like the last 3 years, one last thing before I give you a chance is I am very, very excited for the prospect of redefining what is a worker within the formal sector and within the informal sector. Because I think there is some sort of a radicalization that's going on in Sudan that goes back to the very basic and very radical definition of a worker. A worker is whoever he or she does not own the means of production. And whenever we realize that, we're going to have to come up with different ways of organizing, more effective ways of organizing. And like I said, even unions, the way I look at them, we're not there yet, but even the way I look at them are maybe a primitive way of organizing. Answering this theoretical and practical question is going to evolve even more advanced ways of organizing so that we can have decent life, we can restore humanity to the people of Sudan and hopefully maybe to Africa, why not? The whole globe, the sky's the limit.
But one of the questions, because you talked about this, the challenges of the informal economy and in terms of also organizing and this transformation of labor, and also, in terms of state privatization, in terms of all of the challenges that creating this restoration of the trade union movement in Sudan faces, both from the state, both directly in terms of the violence, the parallel unions, also the kind of the nature of the structure of the Sudanese economy as well. And one of the things that I wanted to ask then, in the midst of this, how is the Sudanese Workers Alliance for the restoration of trade unions organize, especially amongst the more, let's say, within the informal sector, and is that organizing taking place? But also one of the things that, and whether it relates to or not, I could be off, because one of the unique things about the Sudanese revolution from the beginning, that you haven't seen this demand put in place in many of the revolutions across the entire region, was the full sovereignty of the Sudanese people and the Sudanese state, right? In terms of foreign interests, foreign capital, and especially the role of foreign investment in terms of encroaching on land, so in terms of thinking about informal labor, or agricultural labor, or also that aspect as well. Maybe that's a bit convoluted, but those two aspects, if they're related, maybe they're not at all. And maybe can touch upon both of them.
Okay, so I'll try to give my insight on that. So SWARTO is actually an umbrella. So there is different unions within SWARTOs, and there's also individuals who are interested in organized labor, generally speaking. And we basically, our vision is, we work from a theoretical point of view, and we also facilitate solidarity and making connection between different working sectors based on their mutual interest. And we build on a legacy of Sudan labor union movements. And I would like to just mention that Sudan have always organized the working class before the state recognized that.
Before our independence from the British Egyptian rule, we had organized labor, we had unions, and we never really need the recognition of the state. As long as there is workers, there is a working class, and there is a need to organize that working class. And we have, we the working class of Sudan, we are the people who create the value. And from that point of view, we are the people who, the state basically should be working for us, not the other way around. So we build on the legacy, like I said, of the organized labor in Sudan with principles like freedom of association and collective bargaining. It's basically based on the independence and democracy of trade unions or organized labor. And when we say independence, it's basically mean independence from the state, independence also from the employer. For example, you cannot really have an organized labor movement in teacher sector, for example, if that person owns a school and at the same time that person is a teacher, there is a conflict of interest here, right? Because at some point you're the employer and my struggle is actually against you. I'm trying to get better working condition. Also, they will see this in doctors and in many other different sectors. Within all of that, we also see that the assembly or the assembly, which is basically the collective of all workers, this is the highest power within a union or within an organized labor movement. That being said, the fact that we don't have a union law, we did not have a union law since 2019, since April 2019, that we don't need a labor or like a union law for unions to actually exist. So if we use these two principles, and I think we have like seven principles that's where to work accordingly, if we use them, we can organize any type of labor, right? And even higher type of organization, even more advanced, more progressive, as we've seen between resistance committee and some sanitation workers, for example. Sanitation workers in a specific neighborhood have actually cooperated and worked together with resistance neighborhood committee, and they went into a strike, a resistance neighborhood committee helped, and basically they got better working conditions. So as long as we work with principle, with the legacy of the working class in Sudan, I think there is a lot of avenue to organize that. There's also a lot of movement among, or a lot of tendency among resistance neighborhood committee to come up with a political charter of how Sudan should be ruled. And we have examples and draft of charters where we see power from below, we don't see power from above, right? So that being said, it means we're working with the smallest administrative unit within the neighborhood. And that smallest administrative unit, if we can build a political charter that allow any worker in a formal sector or an informal sector to be part of decision making and to be part of the body that will hold that power accountable, then we've already solved that issue. And we have the political charter from Sinnar. Obviously, I'm a big fan of Sinnar. I keep mentioning it. It's a state in Sudan. There is a political charter that actually work with the smallest administrative unit and allow any type of workers, formal sector or informal sectors, to work within neighborhood committee to build the power from below. So we are reimagining how we're going to build the state, how we're going to build power, and more importantly, how we're going to keep that new power accountable, so we can make sure that the redistribution of wealth and the balancing of the power structure is actually for the benefit and for the interest of the poor people of Sudan. I'm not sure if that helped into your to answer your question.
No, it very much did so. So thank you to Beb. Stefan, do you have a last question?
Well, maybe to just get Doha to talk about what's happening in Montreal, if there's any way for people who listen to this show to find out more, if there's any solidarity actions happening here. Or things that can be done online by people sort of wherever who listen.
Yeah. There is the Sudanese community in Montreal has been, especially pre-winter. I have to be honest, we are not as active in the winter, but pre-winter we were almost all the time in Dorchester Square, actually on Peel Street, protesting. We recently did a march to from Dorchester Street to Phillips Square, where there's the headquarters of a lobbying firm here in Canada, Canadian lobbying firm that actually was contracted by the military. In 2019, they had the millions of dollars of contract to basically polish the image of Hemeti, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, and the military. And there was recently conversations of maybe a new contract. So that kind of prompted a wave of protest here in Montreal, which was followed by protests in Ottawa, with joined by other Sudanese communities from across the country, where we marched to the headquarters of the Canadian, I'm not sure the exact name, but it's the body, the federal body that regulates lobbying firms, demanding for basically amendments in the code of conduct, you know, to not allow these kind of firms to work with dictators, right? There are so many of these type of firms that polish these things, and even this specific firm actually also worked with the junta in Myanmar, with Mugabe. So really, it's very disturbing that this is happening, and here in Montreal too, right, in Canada. So these kind of protests are happening in not just in Montreal, but really across Ontario and BC and other places. So really connecting with the Sudanese communities in your area will give you information about what the next when the next protest is happening or what type of action is happening. Sometimes there's also fundraisers for financial support that is needed by the protesters and the resistance committees in Sudan, right? It's very important to support in ways that people want to be supported. So sometimes there's fundraisers for legal support for detainees or medical care for those who are injured in protests, financial support for maybe providing psychological and mental health services and so on. There are so many of these also online fundraisers going on. There is a really good website, sudancoup.com. Usually it has all these different calls of actions, and it also is constantly being updated with articles that are important and significant developments that are happening in Sudan.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us today. And we'll link to that website and look forward to seeing your work in the future as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Rabab. Thank you so much, Doha.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you, Mustafa. Thank you, Stefan.
حنبنيه البن احلم به ويوماتي حنبنيه البن احلم به ويوماتي حنبنيه وطن شامخ وطن عاتي وطن شامخ وطن عاتي وطن خير ديمقراطي نبنيه حنبنيه قلبي نحلم بيه يوماتي حنبنيه قلبي نحلم بيه يوماتي حنبنيه وطن شامخ وطن عاتي وطن شامخ وطن عاتي وطن خير ديمقراطي حنبنيه وطن مالك زمام أمره وطن مالك زمام أمره متوهج لهب جمره متوهج لهب جمره وطن غالي نجوم تلالي في العالي وطن غالي نجوم تلالي عالي إرادة سيادة حرية إرادة سيادة حرية مكان الفرد تتقدم قيادتنا الجماعية مكان الفرد تتقدم قيادتنا الجماعية مكان السجن مستشفى مكان السجن مستشفى مكان المنفى كلية مكان السجن مستشفى مكان السجن مستشفى مكان المنفى كلية مكان السجن مستشفى مكان السجن مستشفى مكان المنفى كلية مكان الأسرى وردية مكان الأسرى وردية مكان الحسرة أغنية مكان الطلق عصفورة وتحلق حول نافورة مكان الطلق عصفورة تحلق حول نافورة وتمازح شفاع الروضة حنبنيه 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 قلبي نحلم بيه يوماتي حنبنيه وطن شامخ وطن عاتي وطن شامخ وطن عاتي وطن خير ديمقراطي
So we were just listening to our two special guests, Rabab Naeem and as well as Doha Al-Mardi, speaking about the situation in Sudan, the role of labor, the recent general strike, as well as the role of solidarity here, you know, thousands of kilometers away, and its importance. So it was a really great show. I don't know what you thought, Stefan.
I would do it all over again in a heartbeat, Mustafa.
And you can obviously download the episode on www.ckt.ca or on our Mixcloud and on Facebook.
So thanks for listening, and you can catch us every month on the third Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. 90.2 FM in Montreal, or at all the places that Mustafa just listed. So thanks for listening, and catch you next month.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, Chautauqua, Mooneyang, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeAy, recording from home on Thursday, January 20th, 2022. On tonight's show, a special edition of Upstage, I'm going to play for you excerpts from Le Lab Fringe Buzz, a podcast put together by the folks at the Saint-Ambroise Montreal Fringe Festival this past year. My guests tonight include director of Le Lab Fringe Buzz, Sarah Grenier-Laforce.
Trying to find a way to connect with fringe, the fringe audience, because, well, you know, COVID makes it hard. But also, we were trying to find a way to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Fringe Festival. And so the podcast just appeared like a great idea to do that, to connect with people who have been part of the history of the festival.
The creators of the very first Fringe, Nick and Chris Mora.
It was nice to have a place that English theater could dabble in interesting things and try new things. And the Francophone community took some time to come around. But, you know, as that started to emerge, it became a, you know, really interesting place and time in theater.
Early Fringers Elsa Bolam and her daughter Allison Darcy.
Somebody joked at the time, I think we were having a meeting of the various companies, and somebody joked,